Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Oscar-winning director of The Artist Michel Hazanavicius chats to me about his new animated fable, The Most Precious of Cargos. Irish director Darren Thornton talks about his new movie Four Mothers, where an up-and-coming writer looks after his incapacitated mother, as well as his three best friends' mothers as well. Plus, do video games ever make good films? We talk Minecraft the movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy. Or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. And I should mention, we're also going to give you the chance to win a pair of tickets to the new Rami Malek movie, The Amateur, later next week. All of that to come. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. And there's nothing more boring than a radio host coming on saying, isn't it great that the clocks went forward and there's a lovely grand stretch in the evenings? But isn't it great that the clocks went forward and there's a lovely grand stretch in the evenings? I seem to have a great week with that extra sunshine in the sky. Anyway, let's move on. There's also going to be no talk of tariffs on this show. You'll probably be pleased to hear. We could probably all do with a break from that. Sad news in the movie world this week with the passing of a beloved actor, I think it's fair to say, Val Kilmer, always Iceman in Top Gun in 1986, reprised the role in the sequel Top Gun Maverick in a very poignant extended cameo, I guess you might call it, where he found it very hard to speak, but Tom Cruise, in fairness to him, was very keen to get him in to the movie. He passed away at the age of 65. So many roles, you know, a lot of people, it's Top Gun. When we were all teenagers, we loved him in Jim Morrison, The Doors. Not that that was the greatest movie ever made, but he was a great Jim Morrison, I thought. He was also great in Heat. He's one of those people who just seems to have been around forever and we grew up with. So sad news this week about the passing of Val Kilmer. Now, in TV this week, I was watching a brilliant show.
I've heard you are really into artsy-fartsy filmmaking bullshit. You're obsessed with actors and directors liking you rather than being obsessed with making this studio as much money as possible.
Me?
Yeah.
That could not be further from the truth. I am as bottom line oriented as anyone in this town.
I believe you.
Great.
Good.
Good.
Because at Continental, we don't make films. We make movies. Movies! That people want to pay to see.
Yes.
Come here. I am very close to closing on the deal to get the rights to Kool-Aid. And I'm talking a huge four-quadrant version of it.
Kool-Aid.
Kool-Aid.
The red drink?
Yeah.
The guy who breaks through walls and says, oh, yeah?
Yes.
That is perfect. Oh.
Yes, Seth Rogen and Bryan Cranston there. This is from a new Apple series, started last week, I think it was, called The Studio. Seth Rogen is about to become the head of a big studio. Bryan Cranston is the boss of that studio. Bryan Cranston is an old school studio head who just wants to make money, as you heard there. Seth Rogen is torn because he wants to make serious movies, but he also wants to be the head of the studio. And never the twain shall probably meet. So this is absolutely hilarious. I haven't laughed as much all year at a TV show, possibly even in 2 years. I absolutely love this because it's a complete send-up of the movie business. There's no real heart in this. People are pretty rotten in it. Catherine O'Hara is the person who got fired. And Seth Rogen is hopefully going to take her job, and he does, it's no spoiler to say that, but she's still in the wings helping him and negotiating. What's great about this is it's a send-up of Hollywood, it's hilarious, but the cameos from real-life Hollywood people in it are absolutely brilliant. It's like extras for a Ricky Gervais. In the first episode alone, you've Martin Scorsese and Charlize Theron. And there's a whole thing you heard in the clip there about the Kool-Aid movie and Martin Scorsese possibly being involved in that. In episode 3, Ron Howard sends himself up brilliantly. The second episode is all about Seth Rogen going to watch a movie being shot, and in particular, a long shot scene. It's hilarious. So this isn't just for cinema lovers. It's just a really funny show. But if you do love the cinema and how movies get made, you'll also love this. It's on Apple TV. The studio is getting 5 stars from me. It's dropping every week. It's hilarious. Watch it now, people. Watch it now. Let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, opening next week in cinemas is The Amateur. Charlie Heller, played by Rami Malek, is a brilliant but deeply introverted decoder for the CIA, working out of a basement office at headquarters in Langley, whose life is turned upside down when his wife is killed in a London terrorist attack. When his supervisors refuse to take action, he takes matters into his own hands, embarking on a dangerous trek across the globe to track down those responsible, his intelligence serving as the ultimate weapon for eluding his pursuers and achieving his revenge. It also stars Catriona Balfe, the Irish Catriona Balfe, and Lawrence Fishburne is in there as well. Now, I mention this because we have a whole host of tickets to give away. Well, 5 pairs for next Wednesday in Cineworld on Parnell Street in Dublin at 7 p.m. The movie starts. Doors open at 6:30. That's next Wednesday, April 9th. If you would like to go, simply email the word "the amateur" to screentime@newstalk.com. We have 5 pairs of tickets. And as always, if for any reason you can't be in Parnell Street at 6:30 next Wednesday, April the 9th, please don't enter the competition. But apart from that, please do enter the competition. 5 pairs of tickets to The Amateur to give away. Email us, screentime@newstalk.com. Email the word "The Amateur." It's probably easier because we get lots of emails. The wonderful Anne-Marie Kane will pick the 5 lucky winners. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. The big new release of the week is unquestionably Minecraft. In case you don't know, it is a video game that certainly in my house is beloved and has been for a long time. So it makes a lot of commercial sense to make a movie out of it. Does it make cinematic sense? Delighted to be joined now by Brian Lloyd, who was at the same screening I was, which was full of children, to see what he made of it all. Brian, hello, sir.
How you doing?
Very well. So listen, Minecraft, a beloved video game, for people who don't know, it's all about you kind of going around this land and you're mining the land and you're making things and you're fighting dragons. It's a great video game. Had you been aware of it as a video game? Had you ever played it?
I did. I played it briefly, to be honest. And I didn't, you know, those kind of crafting games don't really appeal to me, to be brutally honest. But I could see the appeal of it. I mean, yeah. I heard somebody explain it before that it was basically like a virtual version of Lego.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about creativity. It's all about what you can build. And I mean, over the years, I've seen like, you know, I've seen these videos of like people were able to rebuild Christchurch Cathedral in Minecraft, and they built Dublinia in Minecraft and stuff like that. So I've been aware of it tangentially, but no, I mean, I haven't played it with any kind of great detail. But again, mentioning Lego Movie, I mean, I think that's what's kind of made this film, I think, so interesting, is because they're taking the same tack that the Lego Movie did, which was essentially this whole thing, Minecraft is really just a metaphor for creativity. And
yeah,
that's kind of what it is. It's a film about creativity.
So tell people what the setup is. We, of course, have Jack Black, and we have a very entertaining, I thought, Jason Momoa.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Like, he's kind of, you know, like, he's been a bit of a, I would say, a career rut for the last while, but I think this is the first time I've seen him in something where you can tell he's actually enjoying it and he's enjoying being a bit of a goof. But yeah, so Jack Black plays this character who essentially has stumbled into this thing called the Overworld, which is where Minecraft is set. And he spent many, many years there creating and crafting this world by himself. A young kid by the name of Sebastian Hansen, and Jason Momoa's character, who's this sort of like washed up arcade game legend.
He's channeling Macho Man Randy Savage, I thought.
Did you see Matt? Yeah, I saw, kind of funny enough now you say that, I thought Bret the Hitman Hart with the glasses,
yeah,
and the pink,
yeah,
stuff.
But
yeah,
kind of
like,
well, yeah,
yeah, 80s, 90s wrestler,
yeah,
let's say. And his wife and a real estate agent
all stumble into this portal where they too end up in the overworld. They're trying to get back to the real world, but stopping them along the way is this evil sorceress voiced by Rachel House, who people would know from Hunt for the Wilder People. And all while this is happening, a villager manages to escape into the real world and finds themselves in a relationship with Jennifer Coolidge. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's very Minecraft-esque. It looks exactly like you might imagine Minecraft might look on screen, I thought. So what did you think of this?
I enjoyed it. This is the thing. Now, look, there is a lot to be said for lowered expectations. I will preface this by saying I was going in there fully prepared to disregard this and just be like, this is a cheap, awful, you know, corporate plastic, you know, cash in, nothing to talk about, nothing to write home about. It was only when I was actually watching in the open credits that I realized this was directed by Jared Hess, who previously did Napoleon Dynamite, and he also did Nacho Libre. And I think what I liked about both of those films was that it has a very unique, quirky sense of comedy. It's kind of going for offbeat, but goofy and lovable. And that's very much what I found in Minecraft as well, was that it is very offbeat. It is kind of quirky at times. Not all of the jokes necessarily land, but they're kind of firing them at the screen so much that you will find something that you will connect with and find funny. And I mean, if the whole sort of theme is creativity, it's that, you know, creativity is at its best when it's collaborative, when you're working with other people, when you're, you know, joining together. And, you know, the group, the kind of the sort of the main cast, I mean, they're all misfits in one way or another. I mean, Jason Momoa's character is this washed up arcade player. Jack Black is this guy who's just been spent so long in the overworld, he can't really connect with normal people. The little kid, Sebastian Hansen, has this huge imagination and, you know, is dealing with a lot of real world stuff and can't really connect with it. So he uses his imagination to kind of help himself. And, you know, like it has sort of weighty themes, but it approaches it in a very kind of relatable and a very kind of easygoing, enjoyable way. You know, I mean, like, you know, like the fact that this had like six writers in it, and I believe like Rob McElhenney, who people would know from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, he was involved with it at some point as well. You can tell that this could have gone in 10 different directions and none of them would probably be as good. I mean, there's a whole set piece, there's a whole sequence rather with Jennifer Coolidge that feels to me like it was written and done for a completely different iteration of the film.
Yeah.
But they kind of were like, well, look, she's so good, we'll just tack this in and it'll kind of work as a weird kind of quirky moment. And it does work. That's my point. It works. Like, so yeah, I enjoyed this a lot more than I thought I would.
Yeah, lowered expectations. Look, the thing is, I was watching this as you were in a screening that was full of children and they were adoring it. So in a way, I'm whistling in the wind here because no child is not going to go and see it because of what you or I say. And it's,
of course,
this is guaranteed hit because people love Minecraft. But that you mentioned the six writers, not the problem, because I like you, I had very low expectations and I kind of enjoyed it for the most part. And I thought it looked exactly like a Minecraft movie should look. But I did think the plot was too all over the place. Like at one point, he's wrestling a lava chick and Jason Momoa, and then suddenly a zombie's on his back and you're like, what? And then they go off to this land. I thought it could have been plotted a bit tighter. I'm aware here's a middle-aged man talking about the plot holes in a Minecraft movie. It might sound a bit ridiculous, but I thought the plot could have been tighter. Discuss.
No, you're right. You're right. And again, this is kind of what I was saying was that it would not surprise me in the slightest if the assembly cut for this film was like 5 hours long and they found it in the editing room. And, you know, again, like Minecraft, the idea is that like different parts of it will kind of like slap together and it shouldn't work, but it does work. And yeah, like it's, you know, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, the film is 2 hours long. It's 20 minutes too long. They could have easily cut 20 minutes somewhere along the way and it probably would have worked a lot better. It's loud, it's colourful, it's a little bit annoying, but I mean, you forgive it, you know, that sort of way. I found myself forgiving it a lot because, you know, compared to Snow White last week, or the week before last, I should say, I mean, this was just far, far more enjoyable. It was a lot less self-serious. It felt a lot more original. You could tell that this was made with good intentions. You could tell that this was, you know, aware of its shortcomings, but doing the best with it. And again, you know, like Jason Momoa and Jack Black, I mean, yeah, look, they're being very loud in it. They're being very Jack Black. He's being very Jason Momoa. They're very much leaning into their sort of personas, but it's enjoyable. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you and I are both analyzing this, trying to kind of find out, you know, is this post-structuralism? Is this modernist? We don't need to think that hard. I think you can just appreciate
it. I can't help it. I'm a prisoner of my own intellect.
Same. But again, I think if you can go along with it, if you can enjoy it, think of it like Captain Beefheart, right?
Yes.
Let's just lean into the middle-agedness of it. Think of it like Captain Beefheart. At some point, you just kind of have to let go and just kind of accept that this is going to be a bit silly and a bit crazy, but you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I was going to say Phil Collins, but anyway.
I know, Phil Collins is way too structured. Come on, like Phil Collins is, you know, polished,
yeah, probably a bit too
uber structured. No, you can't.
So listen, the ultimate question then, Minecraft, which is in cinemas, I should say, from this Friday, the 4th of April, it's going to pack them out. I know that for a fact. There's WhatsApp groups in my family already taking place. What are you going to say stars-wise for Minecraft, the movie?
I 3 out of 5. I mean, it's enjoyable. I mean, I think if you're bringing young ones, you know, kids along to it, they're going to enjoy it. And I think you'll enjoy it vicariously through them. So yeah, it's enjoyable.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. 3 stars for Minecraft, the movie. That's according to Brian Lloyd. Brian, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Anything you can dream about here, you can make. Zero limits.
Relax, it's just an iron golem, local security force. But they're a bunch of big softies. Unless you start messing with the villagers. Don't ever do that.
This place makes no sense.
Come with me.
A clip there from Minecraft, the movie, which is very much in cinemas. The kids will love it. That's all that really matters. It's fine for the adults, but the kids will love it. Up next, the Oscar-winning director of The Artist, Michel Hazanavicius, chats to me about his new animated movie, The Most Precious of Cargos. Opening in select cinemas this Friday, the 4th of April, is a new animated film called The Most Precious of Cargos. That's a translation because it is in French. And as I say, it's animated. And what we have is a Europe at war. And we're in the forests of Poland, where a woodcutter's wife finds a baby near the railway tracks. And it seems like, I suppose, a gift from the gods, as her and her husband have been left childless following a tragedy. Her husband is quite annoyed about the baby coming into their lives and is referred to as heartless, an anti-Semitic term. The couple don't realise that the baby was en route to Auschwitz and was thrown from a train. The child's origins become slightly clearer as the movie goes on. The woodcutter initially is quite hesitant about having the child in his life and is downright unpleasant to the child, but she grows on him. And indeed, the mother loves the child from day one. It's set, as I say, very much in World War II, in a forest with the shade of Auschwitz not far behind. It's animated and it's kind of a fable. It's a remarkable watch and it has this kind of real world yet magic realism quality to it. And it might seem strange that it's animated, but it looks like a brilliant graphic novel writ large on the screen. Now, it's from the Oscar winner, Michel Hazanavicius, who gave us The Artist back in 2011, the runaway success that won 5 Oscars at the time, all about a silent movie stars, a very unlikely hit, a great movie. He's done lots of other things, but that is probably his most famous and indelible movie. So I had a chat with Michel Hazanavicius earlier in the week about The Artist and, of course, about his new movie, The Most Precious of Cargos. So, Michel, I gather it took you a long time to say yes to this for various reasons. And the thing that may have got you over the line was your children and wanting them to know a bit about some of this stuff. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's part of the decision. But I was hesitating, and I spoke with my wife Berenice, and I have four kids, but we have two kids together, and I didn't really do my job in terms of transmission of that story. Not because they have to know, but it's my family story, and I never really did that job. And so realizing this, my wife told me, you know, if our kids are not really aware of what happened, the other kids are not neither. So she kind of pushed me to do it, and I think she was right, and I thank her, because I did it for the kids also.
Yeah, great. And you mentioned your personal history there. My understanding is your grandparents would have come from Poland and Lithuania. Did your family have first-hand experience of the Holocaust?
Yes, of course. I mean, they lost many of their families. People, of course, I never known, but they lost a lot of their relatives. And my parents were hidden during the war, and they were kids. And, you know, we never spoke really about all of this. I mean, not in terms of like taking the children and saying, now we have to tell you what happened, blah, blah, blah. It was more, always knew. And it was like some words here, discussion there, but yeah, I mean, it's really for all the families from Eastern Europe. I mean, I mean, Jewish families. It's something really, really important in the families.
Yeah. Now, you probably know this better than I do, but there is great, you know, philosophical discussions about how we talk and how we fictionalize the Holocaust. So like, there's a movie by, as I'm sure you're aware more than I am, but Lanzmann, who did like 9 hours of Test Me, and he was kind of pissed off with Spielberg for trying to fictionalize the Holocaust in Schindler's List, for instance.
Yeah.
You take an interesting approach. Yours is a fable, a story of woodcutters, yet at the same time, we have a train on the way to Auschwitz. So you're doing reality and you're also doing fiction. Is that how you think we need to make sense of things in a way, a bit of both?
I don't know. I'm not sure there's just one way to do it. What I believe is if you try to tell a story about this topic, you have to pay attention of a lot of things, and also of the memory and the dignity of the victims, of course. But the thing is, the situation changed since Lanzmann did his wonderful movie, because at this time it was the priority and was to give the words to the survivors, people who were there, and it was they were testifying. So it was time for testifying, like they were witnesses of history.
Sure.
Now these people are dying one after the other, and that's in the that's normal. I mean, we're 80 years after the liberation of the camps, so I think it's normal that fiction enters in the field of the narration of that story.
Yeah.
And I have to say that the author, Jean-Claude Grimbert, I know him since I was born, because he's my parents' best friend since they were 16.
Wow.
So I always knew him. And his father has been deported. So he writes about this topic since 60 years now, or 65 years now. And I really trust him.
Yeah.
And I think it's a wonderful gesture that he did, telling a story in a fable, in a tale, because it brings the story to a universal level. It's mm-hmm. not just a story about Jews and Germans. It's a story about people, men and women. Men and women who killed other men and women and children. And also, and that's the, where the movie and the story is really optimistic, it's also about men and women who saved other people.
Sure.
So, yeah, so the tale, in my opinion, was the best and very new approach of talking about this story.
Yeah. And did you always think you had to animate it, that you couldn't do this with actors?
Yeah, I couldn't. I could not ask two actors to pretend they are in a train and in direction of Auschwitz. Mm. I could not ask them because there's something I'm not comfortable with this. I mean, okay. Actors are lying. I mean, that's their job. They are yeah. pretending, and it's okay. I mean, in many cases, it's really okay. I mean, when you watch a movie with Brad Pitt as a spy, for example, you know Brad Pitt is an actor, but you're okay with he's pretending being a spy. Okay, let's see that story. But for this story, this very specific story, the question of the representation of deportation and extermination is a very serious topic, as you said, and what we call the suspension of incredulity of the audience doesn't really work in that case. So animation was the best tool because animation doesn't lie.
Yeah.
The drawings, they do not pretend. They are here to evocate. They are a suggestion of what happened, but they don't pretend they are realistic. They don't pretend they are reality. It's like there's a filter between the audience and what we are talking about, and I think it's very it's better this way.
Yeah, the girl who gets thrown from the train, the baby.
Yeah,
she wins everybody over.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give a spoiler, but there's a suggestion that she might be magical. At one point, the woodcutter touches her and feels his heartbeat and then feels other heartbeats. Are you saying that there's some kind of magic realism in this? Or maybe I shouldn't ask you that. Should people just watch it and decide for themselves?
Well, you're right. I mean, each screening is a different experience for each person.
Mm.
And that's the power of cinema. And especially in this one, there's not too much dialogue. So it's a very open story. You get what you want to get of that story.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure she's magic as a person. But what I believe is that she works like a wave of love. And where when she comes, I mean, nobody can resist to a baby's laugh, so I don't want to tell too much about that story, but it's about a baby thrown by a deportation train, as you said, and a woodcutter, a couple of woodcutters takes her, and the woodcutter's wife takes her at home, and the woodcutter at the beginning is like old people in that country at that time is anti-Semitic and he doesn't want that baby, but he will experiment that wave of love and finally he will make the good choice and he will finish as a good person, a decent person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the movie is about. It's about making the right choice, even when you feel like the world is falling apart around you, and so yeah, we can say there's kind of magic in with that.
Let's leave it at that. Some kind of magic, maybe. There is lots of hope in the movie, and there is, let's call it, magic. But one of the most troubling scenes in it, or one that really affected me, is when we go inside one of the trains and we just see utter horror and devastation on the faces of the people traveling. And then there's scenes with two babies and it's just awful. Were you very keen in those train scenes to convey, you know,
people were traveling to hell, because that was my sense of it. And it seems to me this is what my face might look like if I was going to hell.
Yeah, I mean, this is how it works. I mean, they are not really, they're very quiet. And they're in a train and there's no sound. And I trust people to understand what's going on. And people, if you were devastated, it's because you knew where these people were going. Mm-hmm. And you, as a viewer, you did the big part of the job. I showed these faces because I wanted to remember that it's not just, it's one person plus one person plus one person plus one person. Yeah. This is what's horrible with wars and genocide, especially, but all the wars. It's not just 10,000 people died.
Yeah.
It's one person plus one person plus one person, and you go like this 10,000 times. But each person is unique, and each person has a face and has dreams and has relatives, families, hopes, stories. And that's what is killed in wars, people.
Yeah.
And so these faces, that's what that's why they are here. And but there's no, I try not to put some pathos. I try to be very simple and let the audience make the job.
Yeah. Listen, it's a powerful evocation of all sorts of things. Just in closing then, Michelle, can I ask you, and we won't spend long on the artist, but I'm sure you're regularly asked about it, and it was the first movie of yours I saw. But I wonder now, 14 years later, I think it is at this stage, when you look back now, are you surprised by the life that film had? I'm not saying it's not deserving of it, but you know, no one sits down and thinks, I'm going to make this movie about a silent film star and it's going to win 5 Oscars and be talked about, and there's this moment in cinema and a return to all sorts of things, you know, and there was debate about it. Like, you must have been surprised by the life that film had.
Yes, of course. I mean, nobody could expect a story like this. It was a very, once again, very modest movie, very simple. And it was more like an experience, you know, research in a way. And, and you know, it's interesting because you said about deserving it, and I never wanted to wonder, do I deserve it, or does the movie deserve it? Because I think it's a bad question. You always lose with that question. If you say, if you think you deserve it, you're not honest, because I didn't make the success of the movie. I did the movie, and the success came in a second time. But if you say I don't deserve it, I mean, you waste your pleasure, and you don't have to underestimate yourself, but you don't have to overestimate yourself. Mm-hmm. So this question of deserving is not appropriate, I think.
Yeah. Now I said surprised. I were very deserving of it.
I was very surprised, but this was a real fairy tale, a real one. Like, I mean, it was a wonderful story. Everybody loved that movie. Just what I had, the only thing I had to do was to walk behind the movie and say thank you, thank you, thank you, and so it was very easy and very. It was lovely. It was a lovely journey, I have to say.
Yeah, lovely.
But surprising, unpredictable, of course.
Absolutely. And then the very last thing, you know, you've been around and you've done lots of different things in your career. And I always feel honor bound to ask people like you who've kind of, you know, had an arc to your career. Are you worried about the state of cinema in the age of streaming, in the age of people watching things on your phone? Like, you're putting this movie into cinemas, so I presume you still very much believe, and based on the artist, you clearly believe in the power of cinema, but are you troubled by where we might be going?
Well, sometimes I think to myself, I'm happy I'm 58 now and I made these movies, because if I had to make this movie now, maybe I would be more worried. I really don't know where we're going. I know that I still love the gesture of a single movie more than a series, for example. Series are more about addiction. And I like the very simplicity of a gesture of a movie. It looks simple. It has a beginning, a development, and an ending. Everything in less than 2 hours. And with this simple gesture, you try to say a truth, something that approaches a truth. And I love that. And if I can continue, I will continue. I can't tell what the future will be made of. There's many. We have many reasons to worry about, and not only in the field of cinema, unfortunately. So, I think we are entering troubled times. And you know, cinema is the reflect of society. So, one reflect of society, not the only one, of course. But so, if you ask me if I'm worried, I am. If you ask me if I am pessimistic, I am, but I'm still joyous.
Yes.
I'm a joyous pessimist.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, listen, based on the three movies of yours I've seen, they are simple and beautiful, and certainly The Most Precious of Cargoes is as well. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Michel.
Thank you.
I hope you continue to make movies and continued success.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Very nice of you.
Michel Hazanavicius there talking to me about his new film, The Most Precious of Cargoes. It's a French film, largely set in the forests in Poland, not far from Auschwitz. It's a gripping watch, an animated film. It's not a cartoon in that sense. It's very much an animated movie and looks like a graphic novel brought to life. It's beautiful. It's poignant. It's a lot of things. Well worth a watch. And he was also talking, of course, about The Artist, which was his massive movie. And I should say The Most Precious of Cargoes is on select release. And you can certainly see it in the IFI in Dublin from the 4th of April. Up next, a new Irish movie called Four Mothers, where an Irish man has to not only look after his own mother, but the mothers of three of his friends. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now opening this weekend is Four Mothers, which stars James McArdle as Edward, a young adult author and gay man on the verge of major literary success. And he may be about to start a US tour. That's if he can sort out life with his widowed mother, Alma, played brilliantly by Fionnuala Flanagan, who cannot speak after suffering a stroke and communicates mostly with a tablet computer. And then Edward's three gay male friends dump their elderly mothers as they want to head off for a dissolute pride weekend. And so Edward, decent guy that he is, does his best with these formidable four mothers, dealing also with his own kind of private heartbreak, anxiety, and possible literary success, not to mention his own unresolved anger towards his late father. It's a loose remake of an Italian movie called Mid-August Lunch. It was directed and co-written by Darren Thornton, who previously gave us the brilliant A Date for Mad Mary. And I'm delighted to say Darren has battled Dublin traffic to be live in studio with me. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hey, John. How's it going?
Very well. So you co-wrote this with your brother.
Yeah.
And we'll just get this out of the way. I know it's loosely an Italian remake, but your own mother had similar troubles to Fionnuala's characters. Tell us about the genesis of it.
Yeah, around about the time that we were promoting A Day for Mad Mary, it had just opened in the cinemas.
Which is like 6 years ago.
More than 6 years ago. It's actually 9 years
wow,
ago.
Wow, sorry. So, yeah, Tempus fugus.
It's crazy. I mean, it's taken so long with COVID and everything to get this finally here, where it sort of blows our minds that it's been 10 years. But yeah, 2016, I remember it well. We were in LAX. We were coming back from LA after showing A Day for Mad Mary at a private screening over there. And we got a phone call and... from my mum's sister just to say that she had that mum had been diagnosed with motor neuron disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just obviously threw our world upside down. And, you know, we were both moved home to be carers with her and to spend time with her. And, you know, at the same time that we were spending that time with her, we were also doing stupid things, trying to promote the film.
Mm.
And there was something just about the how bizarre it was to be for the most devastating news and the best possible news to kind of come to you at the one time, you know, the thing that you might have been pursuing for a long time in terms of your own career and stuff like that was finally happening for you. And at the same time, you were losing someone that you loved more than anybody. And, you know, in addition to adapting the original film, the original Italian film, you know, the other primer for doing it was just that experience of losing her mum.
Yeah, and did your own mother also lose the power of speech?
She did, yeah. The iPad was a device that we took from that period of time. The first symptom that we had, you know, came along that mum, that made us realize that something was up with mum, was that she lost her voice, not dissimilar to Charlie Bird when he became unwell and stuff. And so she needed to use the iPad to communicate.
Yeah.
And that became a source of deep frustration for her, because she was never a great speller and stuff like that. So it would drive her crazy trying to use this device. And it led to her being much quieter then, because she couldn't obviously use her voice, and she didn't want to have to use this device. So for us, there was something sort of therapeutic about being able to use that, reclaim that device, use it as a point of comedy in the film. And so, yeah, it just became the sort of starting point in a way for telling the story.
Yeah. And so that's the personal resonance of it, if you like. Fionnuala Flanagan, and it's not a spoiler to say it, she doesn't really talk in the movie because, as we've discussed, she's working off this tablet. But of course she acts, and she acts tremendously well with her eyes and her nose. Like, pitching it to her, like, what was her reaction when you said, you're not going to talk in this?
The funny thing is that I don't know. That we had our first meeting, and Fionnuala had read the script and loved it and, you know, was really up for it. And but I don't think that she realized in that first read or for a while that there was, that she wasn't going to speak at all. I think the way that she'd interpreted it was that there was going to be some dialogue in it. And then I remember it was the second or third time that we'd met when we were in prepping it. And she was like, oh, you really don't want me to speak at all? And I was like, no, there's no, all of that. Because on the script, it has Alma and then the text that she types out and stuff.
Okay.
So it is easy to sort of, you know, misinterpret that, you know. So
I had to clarify it.
And there was a moment where I thought, oh no, she's going to not want to do it now. And she did have reservations, because obviously, you know, your voice is one of your most important tools as an actor. And Fionnuala has an incredible voice and is quite a formidable stage actor. So the idea of that being stripped away was quite terrifying. Obviously, I felt this was going to be great for the film, because all of that frustration that she would have by not being able to use her voice was going to be grist for the mill in terms of making the film, in terms of her performance. So, you know, she luckily trusted us and went along with it. And then, you know, I knew as we were shooting, I could see that it was great and that she was doing great. But, you know, I would have to sort of remind her a lot of the time, because she would, you know, the other actors were, you know, having that sort of sassy banter going on and stuff like that. And for her, she was just, you know, pressing buttons and being present in the scene.
Yeah.
But the great thing about Fionnuala is the power that she has in a close-up. It's extraordinary, and not a lot of actors have that facility.
Yeah. Oh, she has. She's remarkable in it. Tell me this. Edward, played by James McArdle, he's a writer, possibly on the verge of big success with this young adult novel we keep hearing about and we hear a passage of. He's doing lots of radio and Zoom interviews, and he's really bad at them. And I'm wondering, was there something in your or your brother's life that it struck me as, God, I'm glad this guy isn't on my show. And I can imagine PR people talking to him, and he had his notes. And I hate when people come in with notes to interviews, and you're like, put them away. And I couldn't help thinking you knew that world, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, luckily we've never gone so far as to have the notes thing, but I just thought that was hilarious and sort of the kind of thing that we probably at one point would have talked about. But certainly myself and Colin, when we were doing the the promotion for our first film, we were terrible at it. We were absolutely rubbish.
I find that hard to believe.
No, I mean, honestly.
By the way, don't slouch.
Yeah, there you go. We get ourselves wound up about having to do any of them. And oftentimes on that one, we were doing a lot of things with people in America and stuff like that. So there was a time difference and also
Zoom wasn't as big a thing then.
It was Skype back then.
It
was Skype and they tended to be phoners and stuff like that. But you would... And also, like in the film, we were often doing these interviews at the same time that we might have been helping Mam move from one place in the house to another and stuff like that. And she's chatting to us at the same time that this radio interview is chatting to us. So the whole thing was just absurd and stuff. So, yeah, it just became really important to us to try to filter that into the film. And it tied in nicely with what was happening for Alma's character, that she... had lost her voice and that Edward was trying to find his voice as a creative person and trying to articulate himself in interviews and articulate what it is that he does in terms of his books.
Yeah. Now, the four mothers, when they all land, are great. And, they're, you know, I was going to say a four-headed horseman or something like that, but they're a kaleidoscope of mothers. And I'm wondering, I won't say what age she is, but my mother is getting up there and she's still fitting well. But I thought of her a few times, with one particular mother I won't get into. Has that been the reaction of some people, that they see their mother in one of those? It doesn't have to have been, but that was my reaction.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly a lot of our family have gone to see it and have cousins and, you know, friends and stuff, and have said that to us, that they see their own mums and stuff in it. And yeah, and we, you know, when we were writing these women, we were spending a lot of time at home with mum and stuff like that. And mum's loads of sisters and loads of friends and stuff that would be over in the house, and they'd be chatting and that kind of thing. And we'd just be listening to the conversations, and obviously on some level it all sticks. And at the time we came to write, we were just sort of reflecting back on those conversations that we had and things that came up. But yeah, I think there's definitely... You know, there's something very specifically Irish,
definitely,
about the women and about their points of view on things and stuff like that. So I think it's easy for people to see their parents in there. I hope so.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. You know, we were talking about, you know, talking with a laptop, and when I said in the introduction, he's issues with his own anxiety and his unresolved father issues that anyone being alive, I think, has. But it's also very funny, and it's Irish funny. Is that your modus operandi? This is how we deal with difficult things. I don't mean make a laugh out of them, but humor is essential.
Definitely, humor is, and it's so. I mean, it's universal, but it's also very Irish that when we're confronted with something that's emotionally kind of devastating in a way, we have to use humor to get ourselves through it.
Yeah,
and I think certainly for me and Colin, after we lost him, it was like, well, we have to write this and it has to be a comedy.
Yeah.
Because there was no way that we were going to regurgitate the graphic nature of what we may have been through. It had to be a comedy and it had to be a celebration. And so we just, you know, a lot of the time that me and Colin were big cinema goers, and my mum was as well and stuff like that. And so the three of us would always go, and my dad too, as well, the four of us would go to the movies all the time when we were kids, but also as teenagers and as adults. And the genre that we would gravitate toward the most was comedy.
Yeah.
And so we knew it needed to be a comedy. And so, yeah, it just became, you know, the idea of being able to make a film that was able to sort of oscillate between, you know, it's not broad comedy, but a character-based comedy, and then pathos was really appealing to us. And I guess probably that is our USP in some ways, to oscillate between those two things.
Yeah, I don't want to give any kind of spoiler, but there's a slight road trip dimension to it as the movie goes on, which I really like as well. Was that always, did you want to get them on the bus, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah, there was, I mean, again, it all goes back to just to the mum and stuff like that. And, you know, I just remember all these stories from my mum about going to faith healers and to...
They visit a faith healer.
They visit, like, mediums, like all these kind of fortune tellers. They just loved all that. Like, so we knew at some point we have to get a sequence in where they go to visit a fortune teller. And then we thought, well, we should have that be the climax of the film, where all the, you know, family secrets come out into the open and stuff like that, is in the middle of a sort of a medium session with a fortune teller and stuff. So, yeah.
And one thing I really like about it, and I make this point a lot, is, and it's happening more often than not, the protagonist and his friends are all gay, But it's so unremarkable now, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Whereas 10 years ago, the idea of having the four principal characters outside of the four, or the four mothers all being mothers to gay children would seem like, oh, that's just, you're doing that for the times. But yeah, it was unremarkable. So maybe I shouldn't even be remarking on it. But were you keen to make the four mothers, mothers of gay children?
Yeah, it just became something that we sort at the very beginning of working on the adaptation, we said, we both looked at each other and went, oh, Edward has to be gay. It just makes sense. And the reason for that was because I remember at the time that we were going through things with my mum, Colin would, my brother Colin, who I co-write with, would talk about like being, he was turning 40 and he was talking about being a single gay man at 40 and how, how that was making him depressed, the notion of that was making him depressed and stuff. And so we kind of laughed about that a lot. And so we kind of thought, oh, well, that's a great place to start with Edward.
Yeah.
And also there's a certain difference between the way in which I think the relationships that maybe mothers have with their gay sons versus the ones that they have with their straight son.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real intensity to that bond oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that sometimes it falls upon, if a son or a daughter is gay, it falls upon them. There's an expectation that they'll step into that role because oftentimes they don't have children and they don't have families and stuff like that. So it's like, oh, well, of course you're going to do this. It's just expected of them.
Yeah.
So that seemed like a really interesting place to start the story from as well.
Yeah. So look, the movie's out in the world from tomorrow, 4 months. And I should have mentioned Rory O'Neill and Garrod Farley and all are great as his pals who ditched their mothers. Rory O'Neill really made me laugh. He's 53 funny, heading off to lie in the beaches. But it's out in the world from tomorrow. You've been living with this for more than 6 years now. Are you it feels like a very personal movie. Are you apprehensive about it finally being released?
Yeah, unbelievably. I mean, we're just hoping that it's, you know, we can draw people into the cinema now, you know. It's I think in the moment that we're in right now, people are so, we've just, our generation, like Gen Xers, has sort of become so addicted to streaming and stuff like that you really need to, you know, do something special to get people out of their houses and into the cinemas. And comedy is just that amazing thing to experience within a community of people at the cinema. So we're just apprehensive about you know, people showing up now. I mean, I feel like we're happy with the film and we've got that, the validation that we really hoped for from that. And now it's just a question of sort of getting folks in to see it, you know.
Well, we will try and help you do that. Four Mothers is a great watch, a very charming watch. It's in cinemas. So it is now in cinemas, I should say, when you're listening to this show. I've been talking to its director and co-writer along with his brother Colin, Darren Thornton. Darren, thanks a million.
Thank you, John.
Hey, I need to talk to you in private for a minute.
Want to go to Galway?
What?
Want to see more of the medium?
Mom, what are you talking about?
Galway. Medium.
Your mummy was showing us these videos of Maura the medium, and Rosie was saying we should find out if she did in-person mediation. Anyway, we sent her a message on Facebook, and to cut a long story short, she's booked us in for a session at 4 o'clock today.
We just want to know that they're at peace.
Who?
Your daddy.
And Nigel.
And Barry.
I just fancy the idea of a road trip.
A clip there from Four Mothers, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 4th of April. And a charming Irish movie it is too. And you heard most of the Four Mothers there, if not all of them. And as I say, that's on release from this Friday. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the great Rashida Jones. She's in one of the new episodes of Black Mirror, which is arriving. So all of that to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.